and stuff.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Call to order the House Education Committee for the 8th of February, 2017. Okay, what we're going to do is I'm going to gavel to open a work session on to adopt committee measures. We have one committee measure that's in front of us, and I will have you. Are you going to talk about it? It's on OLIS.
Yeah.
And so, but this is just a reminder with any sort of committee bill that we're just moving it out of committee. We're not voting on the merits of the bill, whether we like it or not. It's just to get it introduced as a committee measure. Mm-hmm. And so we will have a motion. Mm-hmm. And then explain it.
Chair Doherty, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as committee bills. LC-1224, dated December 5th, 2016.
Okay. Representative Fernandez moves LC-1224 to be introduced as a committee bill. I was going to say, is there any discussion, but would you like to explain what it is? And then we can have some discussion.
Yes. Yeah, so it's legislative concept 1224, and it directs the Department of Education to develop a method for analyzing student progress toward high school graduation, and it takes into account the change in degree of credit deficiency among credit deficient students, and it changes the dropout rate among credit deficient students.
Okay. And so that's what it is. Any discussion on this? Okay. If not, will the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative Evans?
Who's that?
She excused.
Excused.
Representative McClain?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Excused.
Representative Solman?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Representative Bio?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. The measure will be introduced as a committee bill. Okay, with that, we close the work session on possible committee bills and open up an informational hearing on ballot measure 98. Now, a couple of things I want to bring up about this is simply an informational hearing more on the technical parts of the bill. It is invited testimony only. There's no sign-up testimony. We'll be dealing with this with the 98 measure further along in the session for more opportunity for people to give input. But at this point, we are just hearing from the practitioners, and it's an opportunity for the agencies to discuss the technicalities of the ballot measure and find any concerns that need addressing. And we'll have other ones. So with that, I call up the first panel, and it will be Pasara of ODE and Cole Gill from the Chief Education Office. And Emily. Thank you. Okay, we have Sanford Children first. You want it?
Excellent. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Para Sechanrami. I'm a Policy and Advocacy Manager for Stanford Children. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak on this panel today, and I also want to thank all the folks who have been involved with the implementation work from the Oregon Department of Education to the Governor's Office, as well as all of the colleagues at all of the different education associations and educators across the state for their engagement on this important issue, because the dialogue has been extremely rich, and I believe that our kids will be better served for it. You asked us to help introduce the measure, so allow me to give a quick overview of the measure before I go into some of the frequently asked questions, and I hope that we have an opportunity to address them. So first off, Measure 98, which was passed by a 65% vote, creates a high school graduation and college and career readiness fund. This fund is to provide $800 per high school student per year for a total of $294 million per biennium. So the monies in this fund will be distributed to districts using the same mechanism as the state school fund. And this, to clarify, is not a competitive grant. Each district has its own allocation based on the number number and type of high school students in its schools. Districts shall use these funds to establish and or expand career technical education programs, college level and college prep courses at the high school level, as well as proven dropout prevention strategies. This amount is based on the estimated cost of bringing all three programs to scale statewide to improve high school graduation rates as well as college and career readiness. And to clarify, this funding would be on top of the state school fund. Each district decides how much to use in each of the areas and how much they'd want to spend over the biennium as well. I'll also submit some more detailed testimony for the record, giving more background on Measure 98. Now I'd like to take a couple of minutes to clarify some of the questions that have been shared with us throughout the implementation process. So the first question, does the district have to use Measure 98 funding in all three areas, dropout prevention, career technical ed, as well as college-level courses at the high school level? Yes. The answer is yes. And districts can decide how much of their allocation goes within each of those areas. Second question, does the district have to spend more than its allocation on any of the three components of Measure 98? The answer is no. So if you are allocated $4 million for a biennia, then you can spend up to $4 million and not a dollar more. It's up to the district. We've also gotten questions about what does establish or expand mean? Can a district just use Measure 98 dollars to keep doing what they're currently doing? So in the measure, it simply means to establish new programs if they don't already have them or expand on existing programs. Programs in effect starting January 2017 set the baseline for the measure's program and program expansions. For example, District A has a program that's a CTE program and serves 30 students, for example. The district can use Measure 98 dollars to add a section to that program to expand access to more students. The only exception to this is in the event of a loss of a grant or if a grant expires. For example, if a federal Perkins grant goes away for some reason, then districts can use Measure 98 dollars to backfill. We've also received a question about if a district already has a CTE revitalization grant, why is there a need for Measure 98-2? There's a need for Measure 98-2 because during the 2015-2017 biennium, ODE received $25.4 million in requests for CTE revitalization grants, but only $9 million could be awarded. So more than 70 districts applied, and only 25 applications were funded, proving that districts are hungry for more of these opportunities for our kids. And then the next question is, what if a district already has high school graduation rates? Do they have to implement Measure 98? The answer, in short, is no. All districts have the option to choose whether or not they apply for Measure 98 dollars. And we certainly encourage districts to pursue the opportunity if it makes sense to customize and sequence their programs. And last, can a district use Measure 98 dollars for middle school programs? And for that, the reason why it's focused just on high school is because when we look at how kids are doing on our national assessment of education progress, our eighth graders are well above the national average. But from that transition, that leap from middle school to high school, our kids are falling off a cliff. And we're seeing a huge disparity between the trajectory that our eighth graders on and where they end up at the end of high school. And so that's why high school has been prioritized here. I've also handed out a few documents for you, the analysis of NAEP data from ECO Northwest, as well as the coalition members who supported Measure 98. Once again, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. And I'm available for any questions.
Okay, thank you. I think what we'll do, we'll wait till the panel is all done and we'll have questions. Okay, Ms.
Okay, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm going to give you an overview of the ballot measure, how it works, who's impacted by it, and then I'll talk briefly about the State Board of Education's rulemaking process that we're in. So ballot measure 98, it's a 2016 ballot initiative approved by the voters. It provides direct funding to school districts to increase high school graduation rates and college and career readiness. And like Paras has said, districts are directed to spend money in three areas: career and technical education programs, college-level opportunities for students, and dropout prevention strategies. And I bolded and underlined the "and" because that's been a common misperception. Districts have to spend the money in all three areas. As Paras has said, districts have to establish or expand programs. So you can't use the money to backfill for an existing program. There is the exception for grants or federal funds that are no longer available. But for the most part, it's establishing new or expanding on existing programs. The effective date of the measure is December 8th, 2016. And I provided you with a copy of the draft rules that we're working on right now on OLIS. And we've defined expand and establish in the rules. So we've said expand means to increase the course offerings, course participation, supports for students, activities or services available to students. And establish means create or implement new programs, activities or services for students. So who is impacted? The measure states that the money has to go to school districts. So school districts are eligible. Public charter schools are also eligible because we have a state law in Oregon that says public charter schools can apply for and receive any grant that's available to school districts from the Department of Education. Charter schools would have to serve students in grades 9 through 12 and meet the eligibility requirements in order to receive the funds. A charter school could choose to submit their own plan, or they could be a part of their district's plan. The money must be spent on grades 9 through 12. There's a limited exception for spending on an 8th grade summer program, and districts are directed to use some of the funds to start tracking data in 8th grade to identify students at risk of not graduating. And like Paras said, participation is voluntary. Districts do not have to ask for the Measure 98 funds. So who's not eligible to receive funds? The measure says that it has to go to school districts. So state programs are not eligible to receive the funds. That includes Youth Corrections Education Program, Juvenile Detention Education Program, Long-Term Care and Treatment, and Oregon School for the Deaf. Education service districts are not eligible to receive funds for their own programs. By rule, what we're saying is that an education service district can receive the funds if they are coordinating the work of a consortium of districts, they're acting as the fiscal agent, and submitting the biennial plan. So the money's not going to support the ESD's programs, it's going to support the school district's programs that are the consortium. And finally, the measure directly states that districts are encouraged to cooperate and coordinate with nonprofits and community-based organizations, but these entities are not eligible to receive funds directly from the state. So how does this work? The first step is the state board has to adopt rules. The measure says that we have to adopt rules by March 1, 2017. And I'll go over this a little bit more in our rulemaking process, but I want to be clear that we are required to adopt rules and that we have to adopt rules based on the measure as it was passed by the voters. If the legislature made any changes to Measure 98, we would simply reopen the rules at that point and amend them to be consistent with the state law. So the second thing that happens is the legislature is directed to create the High School Graduation and College and Career Readiness Fund. The measure directs the legislature to use a formula of $800 per high school student per year. Okay. The districts then request Measure 98 funds by showing they meet the eligibility requirements that will be adopted by rule and by filing a biennial plan. The first year looks different than subsequent years. So the measure specifically lets districts and ODE figure out a process for the first year that will be less onerous, kind of a biennial plan light, if you will. So ODE reviews and approves the biennial plans, and then we disperse money to the districts. We disperse the money on the basis of extended ADMW for high school students. So ADMW, that is simply the number of students in high school with the weights attached. So the weights for special education, pregnant and parenting, that type of thing. So I want just to be really clear that it's a different formula for creating the fund. The $800 per student creates the fund, but the money is sent out on the basis of ADMW. Oh, and the measure allows ODE to retain up to 1.5% for administration in the first year and 1.25% thereafter. So districts will spend the money according to their biennial plan, and then they're required to report to ODE on their spending and on their progress towards targets that were identified in their biennial plan. ODE is directed to monitor, intervene when necessary, and facilitate continuous improvement. And the Secretary of State is directed to conduct financial and program audits every 2 years, beginning no later than December 2020. So, as I said, the measure directs us to adopt rules by March 1, so we are currently in our rulemaking process. What you have on the screen is our rulemaking timeline. We met the day after the measure passed with a group of small district principals to talk about what this could look like in their district. We had a stakeholder meeting with around 50 participants. We circulated our first draft to the field in December. We had a state board meeting January 26th, and the version of the rules that you have before you now are the version that was presented to the state board. We had an administrative rule hearing on January 30th. I'm going to circulate revised rules next week, and then we go back to the state board for an adoption vote on February 23rd. As I said, we're drafting the rules to comply with the measure as it was passed. We can't contradict anything that's in state law. And so if, for example, someone were to say, we want the rules to say you don't have to spend money in all three areas, what we've been telling our stakeholders and people that comment is the rules have to be in compliance with state law, so we have to require that you spend in all three areas. But the measure itself is really detailed, and so when you review the rules, I think you'll see that we kept them pretty high level, and we tried to maintain as much flexibility as possible for school districts. And then finally, the last page, and this is really small, so I've given each of you a handout so you can see a little better. You know, I'm working on the rules for the department, but there's also a rather large team at the department that is working to implement this measure. And so we are working on the biennial plan template, working on the template for this first year, working on drafting guidance for districts so that they can implement this legislation in a really thoughtful way. So that's it for my presentation. Thank you.
Pardon?
That's it for my presentation.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Gill.
We have some slides as well. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colt Gill, Education Innovation Officer with the Chief Education Office. Thanks for this opportunity to share our process for stakeholder engagement around successful implementation of the High School Graduation and College and Career Readiness Act.
Do you want to just tell me and all?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you. For the last several weeks, I've been working with an interagency team that was put together by our Chief Education Officer, Lindsay Capps, Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor, and our Higher Education Coordinating Commission Executive Director, Ben Cannon. Oh, thank you. This effort was put into place due to the direct tie between the Act and Governor Brown's vision that every student graduate with a plan for their future.
Mm-hmm.
I'll click over here and then you do the real
follow.
Thing. Specifically, the interagency team was formed to collect stakeholder input for two reasons. One, Governor Brown signaled her support for the Act when she designated $141 million in new CTE formula funding to K-12 schools in her recommended budget. And two, to ensure that the implementation of the Act would result in the improved graduation outcomes that we all seek. Our stakeholder outreach included over 40 organizations, including schools, higher education partners, ESDs, and other regional partnerships like RACs, STEM hubs, and the like. Stanford Children, OEA, OSBA, COSA, Oregon PTA, and a number of other membership and education advocacy organizations, Oregon's federally recognized tribes, a number of community-based organizations, including culturally specific organizations and education partner organizations, and then STEM and CTE leaders, as well as business leaders, and a few others, as you can see by the list. Our outreach was done through individual on-site or teleconference meetings with these organizations where we gathered input from them. To focus on our purpose for the stakeholder engagement, we ask that they maintain the primary aims of establishing the CTE programs, increasing access to college-level courses, and implementing dropout prevention strategies in Oregon's high schools, just like the Act calls for. However, we also ask that they consider four additional filters as they shared their hopes and concerns for statewide implementation of this Act. And those were to ensure equitable outcomes for Oregon students, to create opportunities for community engagement and additional partnership, to consider matching the expectation and requirement sections of the Act with the resources that would be provided to districts through an allocation by the legislature, and then opportunities to enhance student outcomes through implementation within a seamless P20 cradle-to-career system, thinking about the pathways necessary from middle school to high school to ensure success at high school, and pathways from high school into higher education or career. Okay. Thank you. We took this input from December through early this month. Our next step in this process is to bring the stakeholders together as a whole group to share a summary of what we heard from the various meetings across the different groups, and then two, to receive additional input on policy questions and considerations that may address the ideas that were brought forward by the stakeholders. I expect the process will continue over the next several days. The interagency team and education agency directors are hopeful that this effort can help ensure the outcome of implementing the Act will end in improved graduation rates and more opportunities for our students in Oregon. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll open this up to about 5, 6, 7 minutes of questions. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that this is something you can address, but it is definitely very relevant to this conversation. I had a constituent just today actually email me, owns a small business, and the struggle here is investing a lot of money in an area over here, but then having state law over here in a different area that kind of undermines what we're trying to do. This particular constituent's concern was, and he even referenced Measure 98 and CTE programs, and he has a partnership with one of the local schools, and the kids are doing whatever it is in their program at school, and then they come to him to work, and because of child labor laws, they can't do any of the stuff in his shop, and he's willing to let them, but as soon as they go back to the school, they can do the very same thing. And he was referencing some kind of saw. But they can do it here at school, but they go out to the workplace, which is, we're talking about soft skills all the time, then their hands are tied and they can't do anything. I don't know if you can speak to that. Certainly you can't change that area of law. Just doesn't make sense to invest money over here and then stop the progress over here.
Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, as I'm sitting here, I can't answer that question for you, okay. But I will bring that back to our CTE team at the department and get some information for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Okay, Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I want to thank all three of you. I know that all three of you have been very instrumental in working forward on this measure since it passed. And, you know, you gave this process, you know, to let us know how many people are in favor of it and who could be against it. The goals are absolutely fabulous, and they are basic to what schools do. We want kids to graduate. We want to have a variety of curriculum, and we want to make sure that we're allowing for advanced classes to help kids go as fast as they can go. But like every other good idea, there are a lot of technicalities and a lot of issues around budgeting as well as just actually getting the work to function with laws on hand. So I just want to mention three. I've already mentioned to Emily, and I think I've mentioned most of them to Prasa, but I haven't gotten a chance to see Colt yet. So if I could just give you three that I think we need to work on. First of all, it's a world where we have limited resources. And so we have a governor's fund, if the budget brings that forward, of $20 million that's in a pot that's supposed to be used for other enhancements. We also have trauma rooms, and we have absentee programs, and we have a variety of programs that are already established, CTE. And one of the other things we don't want to do is make sure that those successful programs that are already on the ground are not going to be allowed to prosper or go forward. And there's been a little bit of contradiction between two of the speakers, and I know Emily has cleaned up one of them in the rules, and that is your definition of what it means to be established or to have new or expanded. And I think we're still going to have to do some work around that, because we've got some programs that have been established for 32 years, and just adding another section, some people read the law to say, yes, that means, you know, it'll meet the measure, and some don't. So I think there's some work to do there. And the second one that I think is the most important of all, and that is that one of you said that they don't have to participate. They don't have to do it if they've got a great graduation rate. They've got plenty of CTE, and they don't need any more dual classes with their community college. But those people are not going to have as much per pupil dollar, because we are required to make a fund. We have to put $800 for each one of those schools into a fund that has been established and is isolated and siloed. So if they do not, you know, want to use that money for programs that they give you a plan for, they have less resources for their school, and they have less resources per pupil. So I'm all for the goal. I'm all for the measure that was passed as far as what we're trying to do. But we have so many programs, and we have so many pots, that some of these schools, depending on size, effort, and energy that they have to expand to get the money, the dollar, to actually spend on those programs, is bothersome to me. And I have had, I will tell you right now, some folks who are in networks or in partnerships that said they can use the money from one pot but not another. So I just want to be, you know, let's get to work on it. But we also have to look at the fact that we have no way to make money, we have limited resources, and we've got to make sure that every dollar we spend on school is spent in the very best way.
Very quickly, please.
Great. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, thank you for sharing that. And we hear you. One of the things that the measure does is it encourages and requires the Department of Ed to continually help facilitate continuous improvement of programs. And so as the Department of Ed, as well as the Secretary of State, reviews what kind of impact our programs are having on students on track in ninth grade and staying on track in high school graduation, there'll be a lot of lessons learned. And I think there's a great opportunity here to continue to share best practices and build on even existing programs. It doesn't just have to be adding one class. It could also be bringing a half-time teacher to a full-time teacher to increase the amount of students accessing a particular course. There are a lot of ways in which a district could continue to expand their program, and I can follow up with some additional examples as well. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ditto Representative McLean's concerns and add my own comments and then a question afterwards.
So, and we have to be done by 3:30.
I'll be quick. Okay. I have the privilege of serving on the Reynolds School Board, and in my conversations with my superintendent, and I asked her, what would you rather use the resources and funding for this? And would you rather have this additional pot of money where you could either expand or start new programs, or put it back into the classroom in terms of fulfilling the current service level budget? And what she mentioned was that she would rather have it for the current service level to meet what a larger systemic process in which our education system operates under. So my question for Stan quickly is, what's your response to that?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hernandez, thank you for the question. In the measure, one of the things that is required is we'd be fully funding the state school fund in addition to Measure 98, so this would be on top of that. And we don't see those things as competing with each other. We see them as essentially complementing each other. And what we're finding is that districts who have had to cut their CTE programs or eliminate dual credit opportunities for kids, a lot of the students are missing out on those opportunities that are engaging and hands-on and keep them in school. And so our goal here is really important. We want to be able to invest in education because it's the best investment we can make, but we also need to make sure those dollars are spent well.
Follow up just quickly. I get the messaging, and but the reality is you squeeze money from someone from somewhere. It's coming from somewhere else, whether we cut it from early childhood and put it into, that's how our budget system works. It's a balloon. So I disagree with that analysis, and I just want to put that out there.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that I want to ask Emily here, and that is when we look at proven strategies about dropout prevention, what does that look like? Who determines that? Who selects from what?
Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson. So the way the measure is designed, a district would submit a biennial plan to the department, and they would propose what strategies they're going to use. The measure has a list of maybe 5 strategies that a district has to do. They could go beyond that if they wanted to. So the measure is pretty detailed in that area. And then department staff that have expertise in this area would be reviewing the biennial plans and working with the district to make sure these are evidence-based, high-quality programs.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Parrish.
I'm sort of curious just operationally how you envision this in year one when you've got programs, school districts sort of racing for those dollars. Some districts will be able to stand up a program pretty quick. Mm-hmm. They're either doing something, they're going to expand something. Other districts, you know, are starting from ground zero. And how do we help protect sort of those districts that really are late to the game, or that, you know, they've really cut their programs back so far, so that they in year one are not losing the opportunity to tackle and chase those dollars? Is there going to be technical support from the department, technical support from industry partners to help get a program up and running? Because I could see it might take a district, you know, 1, 2, 3 years that they've lost out on the ability to really get a program up, get it robust, get mm-hmm. curriculum organized and moving, and they've missed the opportunity to tap those dollars because of the time it might take to stand up a program. Are we thinking about how we hold those districts harmless in this process?
Chair Doherty, Representative Parrish, yes. So the measure specifically envisions that the first year is an easier year for districts to access the money. The eligibility requirements and having their biennial plan, that doesn't kick in until year two. So the department is currently designing a template that would be, here is the first year ask for the money. And the first year is really about getting districts ready to be able to get their biennial plans approved, have the data systems they need in place, and that kind of thing. The department is doing a lot of technical support in this area. They're developing models in CTE, advanced coursework, and in dropout prevention about what this could look like for a district that is just starting out, a district that is pretty well on its way, and what we would call like a varsity district. And so districts can see ideas in each of those areas for where they are as a district. And then one thing I would say is like the Perkins program of study for CTE, there's actually a process for developing a program. You don't have to have a Perkins level program in year one, but you start out with one course with one credit. The next year you add, the next year you add. And so that's part of the development.
Quickly. In researching some other issues, came to the conclusion with LC that our Constitution allows that once the legislature's made an appropriation to a school district, that sort of local control piece overrides our ability to say, this money's designed for Johnny and here's what we're waiting him for, a CTE wait, if you will. That once we've sent that money to the school district, we don't actually have much control over how they actually spend it. So is there an accountability metric in this that we give that $800 per student to a school district, and they really don't pop up a robust STEM program, and they don't spend it the right way? I mean, right now, we have the rest of the education fund, we don't have a whole lot of accountability tools once the dollars hit their checkbook.
Chair Doherty, Representative Parrish, I can't speak exactly to the opinion that LC has given you, but I can say that the way this would be structured is like a grant, where we would enter into a grant agreement with the district. It would have legal sufficiency, and the district would be required to report like they do in a grant, and we would have accountability through that grant process.
Okay,
thank you. Representative Solomon.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say I appreciate the information provided, understanding that this is a very collaborative process. I'm impressed, and I'm inspired by the work that you are doing for our state's future, so thank you very much. Want to just mention that I do understand our budget shortfall, and I think we all do, what we're facing for the decisions that we have to make. But looking at Oregon, I do believe we are still the third lowest graduation rate in the nation. And understanding that recently in the Statesman Journal, it was stated that students that had exposure to CTE courses had a higher graduation rate than those compared to those that did not have exposure. So I am very much excited about this opportunity. No matter who you talk to and what political affiliation, when people start talking about this, they know that it is the right thing to work on for helping our students figure out their pathway and where that's going to help, you know, take them. And I wanted to say that I also wear another hat. I'm very proud of the work that we're doing in Hillsboro. I'm on the school board in Hillsboro. And we have a career and college pathways. But there is 196 other districts in our state that I would love to be able to have this opportunity for really working on these programs. So, you know, hopefully this opens up ideas about having hubs around our state that can really help our students and help our schools that are in those rural areas and what we can do there, because we're really this is a, you know, an issue that affects us, you know, in our rural and our metro. And so addressing all those needs across the state, I think, are fantastic. And again, it helps students, economy, business. Two questions. Thank you so much. One, you mentioned this was a concern brought up from the CTE caucus, and the $800 per high school student. There is GED students that are enrolled in high schools. Well, no. They're in schools getting their GED, but they're not enrolled in the high school. So I'm not quite sure if that this is what was stated to me by Representative
are GED Alonzo. Students covered?
Yeah.
And maybe you can just get back to us on that.
Chair Doherty, okay. Representative Solomon, okay. I don't believe GED students
don't know.
Will be covered.
Part two is, and it's final, on the district reporting accountability. I appreciate the accountability piece and understanding, but knowing that there are so many layers to what our districts are responsible for, I'm just wondering, making sure, really saying, can we make sure that that's a real simple process in having the accountability piece, but having it not be 750
Chair Doherty, Representative Solomon, we are really trying hard to look at this and how we can integrate it with other reports and other things that are happening to make this as easy on districts as possible.
And my last thing is a comment, and it is with this. I look at this, and I think this is going to be very hard for small rural schools, no matter how easy you try to make it. And the reason is this is going to be a grant procedure. You've got to have somebody that is going to write the grant. You have got reporting. You've got somebody to do the report. And I'm not quite sure how many of you realize that a lot of these school districts, all of that work is literally done by one person who is also the superintendent. And so I want you to be very, very clear that I think some of the things that you've put in here are really going to hamper small rural school districts. And not only that, but the $800 sounds good, but in a small rural school district where you have to either transport kids or bring people in or do whatever, it's also going to be problematic. And so that's just what my concern is going to be. And then thirdly, anyone that's been in education knows that you don't start dropping out as a freshman. You do that in second grade. And I don't see anything in the measure that deals with at-risk and trying to help some of these kids. The kids that I had that dropped out, they couldn't read. And they didn't drop out because they didn't like what was going on in school or whatever. They just couldn't go through and deal with it. So I think that they really need to look very carefully. Don't start at high school. This starts in kindergarten. So anyway, that's it. Hey, anything else? Okay, with that, thank you very much. The next panel we have is Richard, is it Donovan? Morgan Allen, Lori Wimmer. I like your tie, too. Okay, we hazed you now. It's over. Okay, please start.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to kick it off. I'm Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and apparently I picked the wrong session to change jobs now that this committee has a majority of current and former school board members. Many of my former employers now sit on this committee, so hopefully they'll still listen to what I have to say. But on behalf of our 2,400 members, we want to talk a little bit about some of the flexibility and changes that we'd like to see made in this process to Measure 98. We've certainly shared these with the Department of Ed and Stand for Children and other folks. And I submitted written testimony, and I'll just try to summarize it very briefly. I think the first thing we've heard a lot about is the requirement that you have to develop a plan and spend in all three areas. we think that there should be some flexibility or perhaps a waiver type process. And I'll give you two examples. Let's say your school district has a 90%+ graduation rate, and you don't have a very robust CTE program. We think you should be able to invest most or all of the Measure 98 funds in CTE. Conversely, there's been some talk about small school districts. And I think many school districts, even if Measure 98 is fully funded at the $294 million level this time, there are many school districts that will get less than $100,000 and probably a dozen or more that would get less than $50,000. And trying to create a plan and do expenditures in three areas may not make sense for some of those small school districts. So we'd certainly like to see some flexibility around the three areas. If you can demonstrate that you've made investments or have good outcomes in one of those three areas, for example. The second area has been talked a little bit about today is the issue of middle school. Our members at COSA specifically would like to see some flexibility to spend or start programs in middle school around CTE and the dropout prevention. We obviously know that there's something that happens between 8th and 9th grade for a lot of our students, and our superintendents and principals would like to be able to start some of those outreach programs and early warning, early detection programs in middle school. We think that would be an appropriate use of Measure 98 money, as well as because of some of the investments the legislature has made, more and more school districts have or are starting robust CTE programs, but they're really lacking in many of our middle schools, and we'd like to be able to expose some of those students to CTE programs a little bit earlier before they get to high school. I think one of the things, and this is actually not in the measure, this is related to the administrative rules, and we had the folks from the department explain a little bit about what they're doing. And I think I would give high praise to the department on their process. They've been really good about listening to stakeholders, getting feedback, listening to all comers, and trying to be as flexible as possible with the measure they have before them. As you heard, they can't make changes because it's in statute now. One of the concerns is around CTE, and you heard my friend Emily talk a little bit about Perkins and course of study. The rule as drafted by the Department of Education would require Measure 98 funds that are spent on CTE to be part of establishing or part of an already established what's called a Perkins course of study, which essentially means you'd have to have some sort of process where students have growth and take multiple classes, you know, on the way to an industry type certificate or something that progresses them along the way. And really, that's just a fancy way of saying, at least from a layperson like me, is that you couldn't have a standalone CTE course. So let's say, for example, your school district wanted to have a CTE course about laser beams, just to make that up. Under Measure 98, unless that was going to be part of or was already part of a CTE course of study under the Perkins definition, you could not use Measure 98 money to have a CTE standalone course at your high school that dealt with teaching students about lasers. So that rigor is not required or specified in Measure 98. That was something the department added in a rule, and we've heard a lot of feedback from superintendents and administrators that they'd like to see that opened up, particularly for small school districts. And we think it may have the unfortunate side effect of stifling some of the CT innovation that some of our schools may be looking at. And I think just a few general comments, and I think these have already all been echoed in the discussion today. I think our members are concerned about the ability of the legislature to provide continued sustained funding for this program, particularly in our budget environment. We're also concerned the measure doesn't really have any discussion about a safety valve. And so let's just imagine, let's say the governor's budget was passed into the law. So we would have school districts making significant cuts to their K-12 programs, while at the same time they would be adding specific programs at the high school level. And you can imagine, particularly as a school board member or a principal or a superintendent, trying to explain to your community why you're laying off classroom teachers in grades K-8, but you're adding a CTE program or expanding a current program at your high school. So we're not saying that the money should just be a free-for-all and you should spend it however you want, but I think there needs to be a serious discussion about, in times of recession or in times of budget cuts, that there needs to be some sort of flexibility around that. And I think the department has done a good job in the rules trying to minimize the paperwork burdens on school districts and things like that, but that's something that we hear a lot of concern, again, particularly from small school districts, about the reporting requirements. So those are our brief thoughts on Measure 98. We appreciate the opportunity to share them and look forward to the good collaboration that's already occurring on the measure. Thank you.
Next.
Madam Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, and we thank you for asking us to reflect on the measure as you've heard it described. We are very excited that the voters of Oregon support public education and a well-rounded public education at that, as exemplified by some of the items in Measure 98. And we are also excited that you have an opportunity, because it's statutory, to make improvements where they are warranted. We do have some concerns, but as so many have said, it's not the what, it's the how. And you have my written comments in your OLIS system, so I will just hit a couple of the high points so I'm not duplicating the words of others. One of the key pieces, and of course this is about funding, but I'd like to take a different approach. It's not just that it earmarks money in a way that takes it off the table for other uses in a resource-scarce environment, but it's money that, because it's in the grant and aid budget now for the Department of Education, literally pits this program against other programs for our most vulnerable students. And to give you a couple examples, early intervention, early childhood special education services, Oregon pre-K, youth development programs, and the Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund. Those are just a few of the grant and aid monies that will have to compete in the target of cuts with Measure 98 for funding in this current biennium. It's additionally true that though there are fail-safes, as mentioned by the Stanford Children Representative, in the measure, they contemplate only a recession-related, not a structural deficit-related reduction in resources available for K-12. It does not say in there anything about funding the state school fund first at a current services level, and furthermore, the fail-safes are only for two biennia and then never again. So future legislatures would have to revisit the statute itself in order to make other funding arrangements in the third biennium or forward. It's also true that efficiency is most critical right now, and that, as you've heard from others, there are duplications of efforts. There are programs already underway at the department level, in school districts, and so on, that would have to either be set aside or this program would fund duplication of efforts in some places, and we don't think that that's useful when we have so little to spread around. Flexibility, my colleagues have also mentioned, we really strongly feel that it dilutes the power of this grant to do well by the students, depending on what the need is in any individual district, by forcing an expenditure in all three areas. Only those closest to the students know best what's needed in that area. You'll be hearing a bill on Monday, for instance, that seeks to add agricultural education to the CTE portion of this program. That's an example to you of how the measure failed to contemplate all the different ways students really need support. And so in an advisory group meeting a few months ago that I attended, I heard the author acknowledge this problem and say, well, you could spend $1 out of $100 on Part A and $1 in Part B and then $98 in Part C. If that's true, why couldn't you spend $0 in Part A and $0 in Part B if Part C is the thing you need? So it seems to me that not all districts are alike, not all schools are alike, not all students are alike. Let them decide how to use resources if we have them to spend. We also believe that there's a way to solve both the funding and the flexibility question very simply, and that is to look at a model that's worked very well, that's already in your statutes, and that's a school improvement fund that was created. It creates a list of approved expenditures, so this could be those three. And then when money is available, the legislature has funded that grant. Districts may apply for that grant. They balance accountability with flexibility and local control, and the resources are distributed to programs directly that serve those approved programs. That is a model that I think would solve all of these problems and also retain that local control that's so important. We also want to point out a piece of the bureaucracy that you haven't heard much about that is created by this act, and that is not in the Department of Education, it's in the Secretary of State's office, and that is a performance audit of every grant recipient every year. I used to be the vice chair of the Business Best Practices Advisory Committee, and that is explicitly what we did, is looked at creating performance audit programs. And I know from that process that it can cost $100,000 to $150,000 and take an enormous amount of time. So we're talking about an onerous burden on recipients to be audited every year as grant recipients. And it's not a municipal audit. It's not a financial audit. It's a program audit. And so if every district, because these are supposedly not competitive grants, so every district in theory could get them, if we had 197 districts who all had this money, and everyone had to be audited every year, that would be nearly a $40 million biennial cost to the state over the top of the $800. By the way, $750 of which per pupil goes to the district, $50 gets retained by the department for its expenditures, for its considerable piece of bureaucracy, which I also outline in my written testimony. We agree that middle school students are students who have that's the place we have the most opportunity to engage and re-engage students who were starting to lose. You may not see it till high school, but that's a critical place for a lot of kids, and it would be great if districts could have that opportunity. Finally, we also believe that quality is important and that a fully licensed and endorsed teacher needs to be in charge of every classroom, not the nonprofits, not those other partnerships that are mentioned in the Act. And to that point, the TSPC has mentioned that they are working on an endorsement for CTE, but it's not completed yet. The effective date of this Act is July 1st of this year, and we already had, before the Act ever passed, a huge shortfall of CTE teachers. How are they all going to be compliant by July 1st? We don't have the teachers. So I was pleased to hear, finally.
Yeah, you're cutting into Mr. Donovan's time here.
This is my last sentence. I was pleased to hear that it is not an obligatory program, but I would urge this committee to look at Section 14 of the Act, which seems to imply otherwise. If it's truly voluntary, we need to make that clearer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Donovan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Richard Donovan, on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. This time last year, I was employed as the committee administrator for this committee. And did you guys know that that side of the dais is a lot higher than this side of the dais? I never really noticed
oh, really?
That. I was over
it's
the
cat.
I feel like that was deliberate. So thank you very much for inviting school boards here to talk about Measure 98. Just to start, OSBA supported Measure 98. Our board voted to support 98. We continue to support 98, but we do acknowledge that there are some places that we could increase flexibility would help districts and school board members. I've also submitted written testimony, and I will kind of just go over very quickly. My colleagues have touched on some of it, but the main area that we think would be helpful would be, again, what Morgan spoke about, what Lori spoke about, increased flexibility in the kind of three-area requirement of the measure. It's very difficult in this. Chair Doherty, you pointed out that provision is especially punishing to kind of eastern, southern, and rural areas of the state. Where schools are further apart, they're smaller, and you have graduating classes of 8, 10, 12 students. And so being able to focus on one area, two areas of import, it's going to be better for those schools and school districts. I actually had a principal come up and say to me, I have 9 kids. If one of them doesn't make it, I'm sunk. And I said, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, it's the kind of thing that we're hearing, and all of us are hearing from our constituents statewide. In that same vein, I just also want to echo the idea that Chair Doherty, you spoke to and Morgan mentioned about spending these monies, the ability to spend these monies at all grade levels. We would actually go beyond a middle school ask and say that while the count occurs at the high school level, and that's fine in the text of the measure, Chair Doherty, as you said, kids don't start dropping out in ninth grade. I had the suit from Baker, Mark Whitty, said to me, we start talking to kids about CTE in fourth and fifth grade. That's when we start talking about preparedness, college readiness, and career track positions. That's when they get interested in these programs. How am I going to do this? If I got my sixth graders talking to me about classes and I have to parse out what I can or can't spend money on, it's going to be really difficult. And so we think it's still within the spirit of the measure to kind of open the ability to fund, especially as the state moves towards models statewide that say 6 through 12, kind of P to 20, P to 14, that increased ability to spend money throughout the school would really be great. There's a couple more points that I don't think have been brought up. OSBA, in kind of keeping that focus on small and rural schools, would love to see some discussion around a funding floor for schools and school districts. Some of the very small school districts anticipate getting a few $1,000s. I mean, they're very small schools. There's not very many of them. But then there are tens of schools that expect under $25,000, under $50,000. And it's very hard to do one area of study, let alone all three, as the measure requires, with any sort of quality at that level of funding. The measure permits consortiums, ESD-based solutions, and those are great, and that will work for some of these smaller districts. But I don't think it's reasonable to expect all districts to be able to use those tools. And so just kind of, we do funding floors for smaller school calculations in every other part of the education in the state. There's an ESD minimum, there's a small schools calculation, the weight. It seems to make sense to continue that funding at the small schools level for Ballot Measure 98 as well. Two more points that I want to hit on. One is just kind of the idea of a longer grant cycle. It's difficult, and I have a lot of school board and former school board members on this committee. Biennial planning, budgetary planning is difficult enough as it is. The idea of going out and trying to establish a really high-quality CTE, dropout prevention, college prep program on a two-year, 18-month, 12-month cycle is really challenging. You, as a school member, as an administrator, as a teacher, you're never going to be able to say, I can commit that for the duration of your high school career, the duration of your middle and high school career, you, student, will be able to participate in these programs. And just being able to bank on having, being able to recruit quality teachers, assuming that we can find quality CTE teachers because there's a dearth, just being able to find them and kind of having a longer grant cycle would allow that to really flourish and all these programs to be more solid. Finally, I wanted to bring up the idea of kind of the language in the text of the measure around supplement versus supplant. I know that Parasa from Stan spoke to it, the idea of you know, this the intent of the measure is to have new programs, expand programs, existing programs, do new things, make it greater. That's laudable, and that's good. But we're in a tough budget. I don't know if anybody's noticed, we're in a tough budget year. Also, you know, it's a trend, even at the federal level, we're moving away from that trend of supplement versus supplant. I mean, in ESSA, the feds just kind of pulled the rule to permit supplanting it with these type of funds. In a lot of cases, like the example that Morgan said where you're cutting $1 million, this is an example from a principal, a soup in the Cascade School District, you're cutting $1 million but looking to spend another $150,000 on Ballot Measure 98 programs. It might make more sense just to preserve what's working already, and we'd like to give school districts that option. It also eliminates kind of the unsavory outcome of schools closing a successful program and then opening a brand new program that looks very similar to the program that just closed with very similar course offerings, which is within the keeping of the text of the measure, but perhaps not the spirit. And we just think that the increased flexibility in these areas would really help school districts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions you have, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. We have about 4 minutes for questions. Any questions? Okay, Ms. Rep. Springer and the Rep. Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this really isn't one for any of you to address. I just want to get this concern on the record so it can be addressed. A few years ago, I don't even remember what the initiative was. There's been tons of them. My concern was the grant writing ability of small school districts. And I was promised and guaranteed, we all were on record, that there would be money in ODE's fund to help districts. I was new and didn't ask enough of the right questions. The key question would have been how much money is in there and how much will be used to support schools. I can't remember the figure. It was absolutely, positively ridiculous. And I never talked to a school district that was able to access that service. So I want to be careful. When we're talking about ODE will help you write these grants, be assured I'm going to ask very specific questions on how much that money is, how much money is there, how it's going to be used, and if it is going to make sense for a small district, call up and say, help me get this grant.
Excellent point. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Lori, I want to repeat something or ask you back. Did I hear you say that OEA's position is that you are not supportive of these dollars going to nonprofits to do this work? And if that is what I heard, can you expound upon why?
Madam Chair and Representative Parrish, what I said is that we want to make sure that in the education portion where we're teaching students that we have a fully licensed, qualified teacher in front of every classroom.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on ballot measure 98. And we're going to have something, and I'm going to open up, we're going to have something a little unusual. We're going to open up a public hearing on four bills at one time. They're all fairly similar, at least in theme. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, do I have to open up four at one time? So I'm going to open up, a public hearing on House Bill 2528, House Bill 2529, House Bill 2530, and House Bill 2536. Okay, so if the panel wants to come up, and if, Alethea, if you could read kind of a summary of what some of the bills are, I would appreciate it.
Yes. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2528 appropriates money from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Education for training and professional development of school district personnel on the contents and implementation of the Comprehensive Guidance and Counseling Framework. The measure takes effect on July 1st, 2017. The Dash 1 Amendment appropriates $240,000 out of the general fund. This is available on OLIS. House Bill 2529 requires the applicant submitting for a preliminary administrative license by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission complete coursework that provides an overview of state requirements for comprehensive school guidance and counseling programs. House Bill 2530 requires that each school district ensures that students have access to guidance counselors who are licensed by the Teacher Standards Practices Commission. And House Bill 2536 directs the Oregon Department of Education to develop professional development courses related to guidance and counseling programs for students in kindergarten through grades 12. It appropriates $250,000 out of the general fund beginning July 1st, 2017. The Dash 1 Amendment removes the appropriation of the $250,000 out of the general fund. Okay, and that's available on OLIS.
Thank you. This is Guidance and Counseling Panel. So, please, Representative Reardon, welcome.
Well, thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee, it seems odd that I'm not sitting on that side, and I do miss it. I think your discussions are excellent, and you always ask great questions. So, anyway, I am Jeff Reardon. I'm state rep for District 48, which includes Southeast Portland, Happy Valley, and part of the Clackamas Town Center area. And thank you for allowing me to share with you four important bills that help support school counselors in Oregon. As a fairly recent classroom teacher, I'm well aware of the critical role that counselors play, and I now have a better understanding of the particular challenges that they face. According to the American School Counselor Association, a healthy student-to-school counseling ratio is 250 students to one counselor. The 2013-14 study conducted by the ASCA stated that Oregon sits at a 604-to-1 ratio, ranking it, as you might expect, 43rd in the nation. That's an overwhelming amount of responsibility and a workload for just one person to handle. We require and expect school counselors to cover multiple services to students, such as establishing career pathways, keeping track of students' assessments, addressing and figuring out solutions to emotional and behavioral issues, preventing dropouts, overall student development, and so much more. Over the last year and a half, I've attended two of First Lady Michelle Obama's Reach Higher Initiative conferences. Excuse me. It's at that first one where I met Dr. Aiken, on the panel with me today at one of the conferences in Jacksonville, Florida. We've worked together since then. I learned so much about the important services the school counselors provide. Also learned about the barriers that they face every day. And so I've been working with the good doctor and the other stakeholders continuously on ways to help break down these barriers. We have that serious lack of school counselors, but I think we speak for most people when we recognize that to hire more school counselors, the numbers that we need is just really not going to happen in today's environment. So we're going to have to get back to what we did in the Tektronix days, where we had to work smarter and on how we approach this. What I'm talking about, and these bills will address, is how do we build a support system so that it's the entire teaching community is helping that student, you know, in a constructive way. So counseling helps students succeed. It's not an isolated function that only happens in a school counselor's office. Administrators and teachers can help. They can help support those counselors by being educated in the field. And we need to recognize that all who work in the school community can play a role in guiding that child. So these bills would demonstrate that the school counseling is a collective effort, and the people here at the table with me are the experts today. I'm going to get out of the way and let them tell you how the four bills will work in greater detail. So okay. Unless you have questions for me, I will bow out.
Have any questions for Representative Reardon? Okay, all thank right. you. And maybe thank it would you. Help, since we've got four bills, if the whatever bill you're speaking to, if you just give us the number. Because it's late in the day. We need to follow that. So anyway, thank you so very much. Please go ahead.
Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, thank you for allowing us to provide testimony on these four bills pertaining to school counseling in Oregon and the career, academic, and personal, social, behavioral, and mental health needs of Oregon students. My name is Gene Aiken. This is my 41st year serving the Oregon school counseling profession, either as a school counselor or as a school counselor educator. I'm currently the school counseling program lead at Oregon State University and also the advocacy chair.
Why did we know that?
Yes. Nice opportunity to wear the colors.
Yes.
And the advocacy chair for the Oregon School Counselor Association. I want to begin by expressing my heartfelt gratitude to Representative Reardon and his legislative assistant, Chris Cloyd, for their support in working with me and others in bringing these four bills to your attention today. Before we present testimony on each of the four bills and the rationale for the bill, we want to provide you with just a few prefatory remarks related to the mental health needs of our students, and then also to the lack of resources in our state to address these needs. Information extracted from the Children First for Oregon website summarizes very well the state of our children's well-being in Oregon, and I quote, data released today in the 2006 Kids Count data book from the Annie Casey Foundation show that Oregon's rate of child well-being fell to 32nd in the nation. Our state's economic, health, and community rankings have all declined. These data prove the urgency of the situation. 22%, over one in five Oregon children, lives in poverty. That's five kids in every 25 child classroom in each classroom in the state. In fact, Oregon's children are poor. More of them live in high poverty areas, more of their parents lack secure employment, and there are more low birth rate babies than in 2008 at the height of the recession, end of quote. So what we know without a doubt that being raised in poverty increases the likelihood that children will have high adverse childhood experience scores, and that higher adverse childhood experience scores predisposes children to lower levels of mental well-being and increased probability that they'll enter kindergarten with major barriers to learning. You might also note that Oregon's teen suicide rate has been ranked 14th in the nation, and we're all well aware of our graduation rates. So, does our state have the resources to address the mental health needs of our children and adolescents? To me, it's quite clear we do not. Mental Health America recently released its annual State of Mental Health report that ranked the 50 states in the District of Columbia. Oregon ranked 49th on the list in provision of mental health services to our citizens. Do we then have the resources in our schools to meet the need? So Representative Reardon talked about student counselor ratios. The school counselor is the one individual with professional preparation to address mental health issues. Unfortunately, student counselor ratios in Oregon have dropped from 440 to 1 pre-recession to somewhere between 575 and 604 to 1 post-recession. Pre-recession, our student counselor ratios were close to the median. Post-recession, we're now in the bottom 20%. A more recent collection analysis of data indicates that in those schools that do have counselors, the ratios may be more respectable at about 390 to 1, but it also appears there may be as many as 150,000 children in the state who do not receive any school counseling services at all. Had Measure 97 passed, we would have advanced legislation requesting funding for school districts to hire additional school counselors. We are aware, however, the budget challenges the legislature faces for this next biennium. Note that it would require hiring approximately 225 new counselors at an estimated cost of $13,500,000 just to lower our ratios to the national average of 490-1. Given the lack of funding to address the needs of our children, these four bills that we present to you today are, in our professional judgment, the next best approaches to supporting the school counseling profession in addressing the academic, career, and personal, social, emotional, behavioral, mental health needs of Oregon's 576,000 children and adolescents. So I'll turn it over to Vili Green. Vili will address House Bill 2528.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2528. My name is Vili Green. I've been a school counselor for the last 12 years, and I'm currently a counselor on special assignment with the Beaverton School District, assisting in the coordination of the district's comprehensive counseling program, formerly of Hillsborough School District. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2528. House Bill 2528 supports the training and professional development of school district personnel on contents and implementation of the Oregon Framework for Comprehensive Counseling. The newly revised framework is set to be released this fall in 2017. The Oregon Framework was first published in 2003 and has not undergone any significant changes since its first release. As a member of the State Counseling Content Panel, we are currently in the process of revising the framework so that it better aligns with the American School Counselor Association's national model. Over the last 15 years, the American School Counselor Association has revised the national model three times. Currently in its third edition, the national model boasts significant changes to how it approaches preparing students to be career and college ready. Previous editions of the national model assess student readiness independently in three domains: academic, personal, social, and career. In turn, counseling programs were developed around creating a scope and sequence of competencies students would show mastery of throughout their K-12 career in those individual domains. In the third edition of the national model, student standards have shifted to mindsets and behaviors for student success, a more holistic and comprehensive approach to preparing students to meet their post-secondary goals. Attitudes, skills, and knowledge are identified to what students need to achieve academic success, career and college readiness, and enhance their social and emotional development. The mindsets and behaviors are research-based and organized around the framework of non-cognitive factors presented in a literature review conducted by the University of Chicago. The review recognizes that content knowledge and academic skills are only part of the equation for student success. Mindsets and behaviors align with Common Core state standards and require school counselors to drastically revise how they currently measure student growth and development, guide the development of strategies and activities, and create a program that helps students achieve their highest potential. In Beaverton, we've begun the process of revising our district's comprehensive counseling program to reflect the changes to the national model and in preparation for the upcoming changes to the Oregon framework. We're breaking down what once was a very linear program in design and transforming it to be more responsive and data-driven. The learning curve is steep, especially when you take into consideration the various levels of training and experience each of our 125 counselors throughout the district have. Myself, for example, attended a counseling training program back in 2003, where emphasis was placed heavily on the original framework. As I entered the field, that was the lens I brought to developing my counseling program. However, over the course of my career, both national and state standards of model programming have changed in such a way the old framework and model are now obsolete. Very much like how teaching, learning, and assessment has evolved, so have the standards of professional school counseling. A recent school counseling survey elicited a number of responses from school counselors across the state in regards to additional supports needed around the profession. Responses such as training for specific veteran counselors who are originally trained under the Ask a National model. Another respondent said that having guidance from ODE and training opportunities would be amazing, since it's been 13 years since any coursework regarding ASCA and the Oregon framework. And finally, a third respondent, you know, said, the more support that ODE can offer, the better in order to support common training among all counselors across the state. If this is left up to local districts, those with less financial resources will potentially be offered less training opportunities. As the state prepares to launch a revised school counseling framework that is deeply rooted in the American School Counselor Association's national model and includes an adoption of the ASCA mindsets and behaviors set to be presented to the State Board of Education, education and training is essential for school counselors and school counselor coordinators to provide students with equitable access to a comprehensive counseling program. The State Counseling Content Panel has been researching options and costs for providing training and professional development that will reach all school counselors statewide and those who work in roles to support the comprehensive counseling framework. An efficient and consistent way to provide statewide training on the updated framework would be through an online platform to assist with school counseling program development, communication tools, and ongoing technical support. The use of an online platform can be customized for Oregon-specific content, aligned with the recognized American School Counselor Association's model program, and be provided at little or no cost to schools or districts. This would allow schools to update their school counseling programs to effectively provide services that are intentionally focused on data-driven practices, equitable outcomes, updated student standards, and post-secondary preparation for all students. I therefore request funding to be allocated for the upcoming biennium that would be placed under the jurisdiction of the school counseling specialist at the Oregon Department of Education to provide such support and professional development statewide. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we're going to wait till the end, but this was the one with 2528. Just for your information, there was an amendment put in, and they inserted $240,000. Into the cost of this, but thank you very much. So if you have questions on each individual, this should be on OLIS. Is that on OLIS?
Yes.
It's on OLIS. And then we'll ask, when the panels have finished, we'll ask questions of all of you.
Thank you. Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Emily Salee. This is my 8th year as a professional school counselor, all of which I've spent at Holcomb Elementary in Oregon City. And to continue our discussion about the counselor to student ratio, just to give you an idea of where I work, I have about 550 kids at my school, and I'm only 0.8 FTE, so 4 days a week. I'm currently also the president-elect of the Oregon School Counselor Association, and I am a doctoral candidate at Oregon State University in the Counselor Education and Supervision Program. I am here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2529. This bill addresses the lack of coursework for potential school administrators in the areas of comprehensive school counseling and guidance, as well as career and college readiness and mental health issues of children and adolescents. Currently, administrators are not required to take any coursework that prepares them to understand the vital role of school counselors. This leads to school counselors being assigned roles and responsibilities not appropriate and/or not using school counselors to their fullest potential. This also leads to ineffective and inaccurate evaluations of the work of the school counselor. Some actual responses from administrators when asked what counseling standards used in their schools look like include one person saying, it is individual by school, not district mandated, and another respondent said, we do not currently have any standards. When asked what types of support and guidance from the Oregon Department of Education would be helpful to you in implementing the mindsets and behaviors, an Oregon administrator responded by saying, professional development for the administration of districts and building. They have no idea what counselors should be doing. Across the K-12 board, there is a steady increase of student issues related to personal, social, emotional, behavioral, and mental health. Most often, school counselors are the only trained mental health providers in the schools, and that's something that we heard Dr. Aiken speak of earlier. These issues are often the source of students not attending school on a regular basis, not experiencing academic success, not graduating from high school, and not prepared to enter the world of work. In 2017, 75% of Oregon seniors graduated high school, and I know Representative Solomon spoke of this earlier, that this rate puts us at the third worst in the nation. 69% of high school dropouts in Oregon are from low-income families. They suffer from lack of services, lack of supports, lack of access to opportunity. School counselors are the one professional in schools charged by the American School Counselor Association competencies and by the Oregon Revised Statutes to work with students on career and college readiness and personal, social, emotional, mental health issues. I am here today to advocate for the need of sufficiently and effectively trained school administrators that understand the role of counselors in all schools. As a representative of all counselors in our great state of Oregon, I support House Bill 2529. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I will be happy to answer any questions at the end.
Okay. Thank you very much. And there was also, on all this, also testimony on this bill, written testimony. Okay, you can stay right there, and we'll have finish up with the last bill.
Thank you.
Or second to last?
Second to last.
Yeah.
House Bill 2530 is the one that I'll be speaking with you about. Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, thank you for your time today and your service to the good people of our state. My name is Darcy Jones, and I currently serve as the program associate for the Salem-Keizer School District, where we employ approximately 80 educators as professional school counselors in our local community. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2530. House Bill 2530 seeks to amend a current OAR 581-022-1510 to stipulate in more specific terms the training requirements necessary for competent, comprehensive school counselor training, as recommended by the American School Counselor Association and addressed by our state and local districts. Currently, school districts are allowed to hire hire people as school counselors who may or may not have come through a traditional school counseling track. Some are bachelor's level educators who have had little to no relevant coursework. Others have related degrees such as social work, but have had minimal exposure to the comprehensive school counseling programs and training. Over the past 20 years, the school counseling field has become a transformed profession. No longer are professional school counselors only schedulers and college choice advisors or a resource for children with difficulties. Current professionals are called upon to now have an understanding of numerous challenges our students face as they look to leave school and enter the workforce or continuing education, as well as an exemplary understanding of prevention practices, which promote the success of every child, not just those facing difficulties. The challenge of students leaving their K-12 education prepared to be college or career ready resonates deeply with us all, as we've heard earlier, and has significant implications for effective school counseling programs. Statistics bear out the many ways our schools now educate our children. Social-emotional training, including the skills of problem-solving, emotional management, and interpersonal relationships, which used to occur in homes, is no longer a guarantee. Mental illness afflicts more and more of our students and families. Many kindergartners lack any idea of how to do school, and we must teach them basic behavioral expectations. Poverty stands in the way of some of our brightest and most promising students accessing their futures. Higher education and financial aid applications now require a level of knowledge that exceeds many of our families' abilities to successfully navigate. Career and technical training is being thoughtfully developed as a solid option for students due to the passage of Ballot Measure 98, and as the point person in the school to coordinate those efforts by all staff in guiding students through their educational journey, some consistency in training for school counselors is critical to build effectively supportive school communities. It is for this reason that I testify before you now for House Bill 2530. As the needs in our community grow, so do the minimal understandings and requirements of this ever-evolving field. As someone who has seen firsthand the scope of our school counseling role grow over my past 20-plus years of experience and service, I ask you to consider the importance of insisting that our counselors operate with a consistent, broad understanding of what comprehensive school counseling programs require if they have not been addressed by their preparatory program.
programs. In Salem-Keizer, we recognized this fact a number of years ago, placing a moratorium on hiring professionals who are not prepared using this model and have backfilled our counselors' knowledge base over time to keep them current with what we now know to be best practice in the field. This has been made possible by local school district support, state support, and or the support of local colleges and universities who have stepped up to assist us in that effort. As a result, each and every one of our counselors has common knowledge of what constitutes a high-quality school counseling program that is responsive to the needs of our school communities. At the risk of sounding like I've been at this a little bit too long and betraying my age, I'll leave you with a quote from the Educational Trust that spoke to this evolution of school counseling back in the 1990s. School counseling is a profession that focuses on the relations and interactions between students and their school environment with the express purpose of reducing the effect of environmental and institutional barriers that impede student success. To accomplish this, the trained school counselor must be an assertive advocate, creating opportunities for all students to nurture dreams of very high aspirations. They assist students in their academic, social, emotional, and personal development and help them define the very best pathways to successfully achieve their dreams. This is an increasingly tall order, but a worthy one. We all know that the landscape of guiding our students and families has changed dramatically over the past 20 years, and the skills of today's effective professional school counselors must keep up. Please join me in supporting House Bill 2530, enabling us to make this happen. Our students deserve our very best efforts on their behalf. Thank you again for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Next. And we do have your written testimony, so.
And this is the fourth bill that.
Yes.
So I'd like to address that. So Chair Doherty and House Education Committee, I'd now like to speak on behalf of House Bill 2536. House Bill 2536 addresses the lack of mental health resources in the smaller communities and school districts in Oregon. I'd like to preface my remarks today about the state of school counseling in these smaller districts by just noting that the counselor education program at Oregon State Corvallis is unique in that it is the one program offered in a format that provides those living in all sectors of Oregon the opportunity to earn a master's degree to become a licensed school counselor. Students can attend two classes a term over 3 years and come to our campus in downtown Salem on two Friday Saturdays each term. I meet weekly with students in my online internship supervision with school counselors working in Hermiston, Ashland, Seaside, Astoria, McMinnville, Salem, Sweet Home, Junction City, Molalla, North Bend, Lebanon, and Beaverton. We also have first and second year students from Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, Lincoln City, and Coos Bay. I previously shared with you information from the Child's First Report on Poverty, and as you probably know, the rate of poverty is even more pronounced in the rural areas of our state, and therefore the prevalence of mental health issues per capita likely to be higher in these areas. School counselors in all of our school districts are reporting significant increases in their students' need for mental health services. Larger school districts, however, are more likely to have developed a variety of responses to these issues, more likely to have central office personnel such as Darcy Jones and Vili Green in Beaverton to be able to advocate for the needs of the school counselors in meeting their students' mental health needs. Unfortunately, it's only our five largest districts that have a counselor on special assignment and assigned to that role of coordinating comprehensive school counseling programs as mandated under OAR 581-022-1510. School counselors in the smaller school districts of our state much less likely to have any central office administrator with school counseling background. who can provide a coordinated response to addressing the need for mental health services. School counselors in these districts are also less likely to have mental health services available in their respective communities to which they can refer their students and families. One relatively low-cost approach to addressing the conditions that the school counselors face in these smaller districts is to make online courses, workshops, and supervision more readily available. Many school counselors in these smaller districts have little or no opportunity for professional development appropriate to their needs. The district, school district, may provide professional development, but it's only directed at their teaching staff. And few districts have the funding to pay for a school counselor's attendance at a conference workshop and pay for their travel and lodging. Online workshops and supervision allow school counselors in these districts to receive the same quality of professional development that their peers in the five largest school districts receive, and have access to other professionals for consultation as issues arise. I am therefore requesting funding be allocated for the upcoming biennium that would be placed under the jurisdiction of the school counseling specialist at the Oregon Department of Education. Educational institutions could then apply for the grant funding to develop and deliver school counselor appropriate professional development services. Note that once the webinars and other programs are developed and delivered, the cost for further development is significantly reduced. It would be our intent that these services would be offered to participants at minimal cost. Thank you.
Thank you. And there is an amendment on here. Yeah, it did say that we are deleting $250,000 and inserting blank. So that is the amendment. Okay, are there anyone else that is going to testify? We've got about 10 minutes. Did we have two more that were coming up? Before we do that, do we have any questions of these panelists?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Vile.
It strikes me that if we were really going to do this right, $250,000 is just a ridiculously low amount of money. But on the other hand, I'm dubious about our ability to do it right and really fund it at a level that would be sustainable given where we are in our budget conversations. The second observation I have is that Representative Hernandez and I had a long conversation the other day and found a whole lot in common. But as it relates to our school districts, we found a great deal uncommon. And I can't imagine that the issues that are facing his school district would be anywhere close to the issues that face the school districts for a place like Cooper Mountain or Sherwood or Wilsonville. And I'm guessing that while every one of these folks definitely needs to be trained, the training would be quite different depending on the environment that they're going to be working in. So I'm just going to reflect that I have at least a modicum of confusion about whether doing this as yet another program at a statewide level is the right approach. When I hear how successful Kaiser's been, I was a school board chair at Groner School many years ago when it was one little school district of 245 kids. We were able to reach out to Hillsboro, to other districts, and get help when we needed it. Mm-hmm. We didn't, and we actually did better then than we're doing now when it's being administered on a statewide level for some of those kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to reflect on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Parrish, we need to be out of here at 4:45.
Thanks.
So I just want to. You guys will understand that I'm very time conscious. So.
I'm curious about some of the ratios. You know, we got this. I'm not sure which one of you gave us this, but you know, looking at some of the states that have a much better school counselor to student ratio than we do, we're sort of bottom 10. But some of the states that have much better ratios also have less per student funding than we do in Oregon. So how are they, and I looked on the website, you know, while we were up here, the education requirements state between those states aren't much different. So how are other states managing to achieve these ratios where we are not?
So, Chair Doherty and Representative Parrish, I do not have a good answer for that. I can say that there's a building research base supporting the importance of student counselor ratios. For example, recent studies showed that the addition of just one high school counselor can increase post-high school matriculation by 10%. Which is a very significant finding, I think. And so I think in many, many instances, school districts are seeing the importance of adding school counselors. I think in Oregon, fortunately, we have seen many districts be able to add back elementary school counselors, primarily in response to some of those behavioral mental health needs that we're seeing cropping up in kindergarten and first and second grade classes. I'm sure you've heard a lot about that from your constituents.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson and Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just in contact with a cousin who just retired from the California public school system as a school counselor, high school level, suburban Sacramento district. He just wrote to me and said, upon my retirement in June, our ratio was 550 to 1. It had been about 440 to 1 about 6 years ago, but management claims there's less money, so our ratio continues to enlarge. Interesting bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to say, first of all, happy National School Counselor
Week. Thank you. How about that?
So thank you very much. My comment is just to say thank you so much for advocating for your chosen path. And you, a lot of the times, are, you know, sometimes just that one person that continues to advocate for your students and your family in the most loud voice that you possibly can. And I just appreciate that. One of the organizations that we have, or committees that we have in Hillsboro, is the BSAT, which is a Board Superintendent Advisory Team, which consists of superintendent, board members, and students. And I'll tell you that students overwhelmingly speak about that student to counselor ratio and what it means for their career and CTE and their career pathway discussions, and what it means for their, you know, the, as you mentioned, the social, emotional, behavioral issues that they are faced with. And so, again, I just want to say thank you, and I appreciate Representative Reardon for bringing this forward. And I just
thank you.
We did not know this was national.
Through the 10th, all the way through the 10th.
Thank you. Chair Doherty and Representative Vile, could I call on Beth Wigan from the State Department of Education?
Well, actually, there were two other people that have signed up to testify, and it was Beth Wisham and Abraham. I can't pronounce your last name.
Actually, that was my mistake. I'm sorry.
Okay, fine. So, Beth Wisham?
So I thought I might call on Beth to address the concern about the training required for the rollout of the Oregon framework and the request for the $240,000, because she and a team that's included Darcy and Vili Green and myself and others, many others, have been working to roll that out. Great. So she can address this.
Great. We got about 5 or 6 minutes, so please.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you. I just wanted to say thank you for the advocates that are here. And as a member of ODE, I am required to stay neutral, but I'd like to talk to you about kind of what's underway and what's been mentioned. So I'm almost within a year of my role. And
you need to identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm Beth Wigham. Yeah. I am the school counselor specialist, and I'm also college career readiness is my area. And at Oregon Department of Education, we have a state-level content advisory panel of quite a few different representatives from around the state. So it's across grade levels. We have higher education, K-12, K-12 school counselors. We also have social couple social workers on there, as well as a few other people in different roles. Administrators, central office staff are also on there. And this committee is advisory is underway with providing input for how we're reworking the framework. And really, the thought was that we'd like to really move towards the national model, which is the ASCA national model, and still include the great things that were in the previous framework for Oregon. So we're moving those into the updated framework for Oregon. Also, we're looking at and underway to adopt student standards, and those would be the American School Counselor, the ASCA standards. And as mentioned earlier, those are around building college and career readiness and addressing the socio-emotional and academic areas. And also for Oregon, we have a fourth domain, which is different than other states, and that's the community involvement focus that we've placed on our framework, within our framework. And so all of that is underway, as well as many other identified priorities for school counseling. So with the gap in school counseling and lead in this role, it's really, we're filling about a 10-year gap. And we've had people that tried to support the position, but really we're working to try to get up to speed with where we should be and we could be. And so that's what's happening with the content panel level at the state.
Great. Thank you very much.
What I wanted you to hear in that is that's foundational understanding for every school counselor in the state, irrespective of the school district and the socioeconomic status of the students in community that they serve. It's mandated in that OAR 581-022-1510 that school districts will provide counseling services utilizing the Oregon framework. If that framework gets updated, then every school district has to know how to implement that new framework. And the school counselors, the money, the $240,000, would be used for the training to ensure that that happens, so that they're delivering the best services that they can.
Great, thank you. Chair Doherty. Any other questions, Representative Hernandez?
It's not. It's more of a comment. I serve on the Reynolds School Board, and we have high poverty in that school district. And something that I've learned throughout my time there has been that there's a huge need for school counselors, school social workers, clinical social workers, psychologists. Have you all tried to create a larger coalition amongst these other social service groups? My sense is that we're not going to get anywhere until we fix the larger root cause of this problem, which is our funding for public education, which many people assume is not a problem, but I think it is a problem. We don't fully fund our education system in a sustainable and sustainable way. So is there a conversation that you all have had with whether it's the teachers or EAs, OSEA, to build a larger coalition to push for the root cause of what's creating these problems in our school system?
Anyone want to try that?
Yeah.
Well, we had had some contact with people promoting Measure 97. In the hope that Measure 97 would provide additional funding for education and mental health services in our state. But we certainly need to kind of re-engage with all entities concerned about education and mental health in our state.
Okay, very short, very quickly.
This year, I've been trying to think of a comment that I could give to people who come to us asking for money for good things. And one of them is if these bills don't pass, where could you be helpful with money that's already possibly in the budget? And so the counseling group that you've been working with, the people at the Department of Ed you've been working with, you need to have them look at the programs that do get money. Look at the trauma room if it got money. Look at the absentee programs if it got money. Look at the poverty programs if it got money, and figure out how the counseling group, how you can fit into something that's already there. And I only say that because it just feels like a bloodbath. right now as far as what's happening with the budget. We've got wonderful programs. There wasn't a single person in here today that didn't have some good thoughts, good ideas on how to help kids and families. But we've got a limited budget, and we need to have you guys help us with the dollars that are there.
Look at the others, so. Okay, any other comments before we, anything else? Okay, I'd like to thank you all for coming down. As I said, we did not realize this was National Counselor Week. Well, yes, we did. That's why we had you down here.
That's right. The timing was superb.
That's why we scheduled it.
Thank you so much for your hard work.
Very, very valuable service that you have. So with that, I close the public hearings on House Bill 2528, House Bill 2529, House Bill 2530, and House Bill 2536. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, we'll see you guys next week. We are now adjourned.